malaria vaccines, school nurses on health, poverty and brain development, and we'll take a look at aminoglycosides. If that's what you're looking for, well, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's program. If you are a brand new listener here, a visitor here to The Nursing Show, I want to welcome you to the show and urge you to head over and check out The Nursing Show's website. NursingShow.com is your resource for all of the information that we discuss here in The Nursing Show. I can only say so many things about what's going on in nursing here on the show, whether it's covering a news item or talking about a specific tip or intervention, you need to follow up. And I have links and other resources that I always use to show you my reference points and what I'd use to discuss different topics here on the show. So I can give you general medical information. It's your job to take that and apply it to your scope of practice, to your instructional guidelines, whatever they may be, and that way we can make sure that we have the best possible information for each of you. Speaking of best possible information, I want to bring out a correction I received. This came in from listener Paul from the University of Melbourne, and Paul is touching base with me about an episode a couple weeks ago where I discussed placement of NG tubes, and I'll have to go back and check that episode and perhaps make a correction directly in the episode, but Paul was making sure that I knew that I was maybe placing too much emphasis on the auscultation of an inflow of air when checking tube placement, and whether I knew that that was going out of style as a best practice technique. You know what, Paul? I did know that, and I really need to check that episode because I may have placed too much emphasis on that. The best way to get a good idea of tube placement is always going to be, at this point, x-ray verification of placement. And then ongoing verification needs to be done in a couple of different ways. We need to verify that the tube is in the proper location as far as the depth on the centimeter readings on the side of the NG tube itself. So you would measure that where it comes out at the nares and make sure you know that placement hasn't moved. You also need to aspirate contents from the stomach and check that with an appropriate test strip. And that's not going to be a litmus test strip anymore. We're going to be testing that with specific tools to test pH and make sure that we are actually in the stomach and aspirating stomach contents. So Paul, thank you for that comment and correction. And you know, I'm going to make mistakes here, and this is a community effort. So I want everybody to be listening. And if you hear an error occur on the show, please don't hesitate to get in touch with me. And that way I can get the correct information out to the other listeners. The best way to get in touch with me is by emailing me. And you can reach me here by email at comments@nursingshow.com. I also got another email in from listener Andrea. It might be Andrea, so I apologize, Andrea, if I got that wrong. But Andrea was checking in, wanting to make sure that I was staying on focus and on target with presenting good quality nursing research in addition to the other information that I present here on the show. And I sent an email back to her requesting that maybe she could help out with that in some regard, and I'll put that call out here on The Nursing Show as well. I'm pretty much a one-man band here, folks, and it's important for me to make sure that we present good practices and talk about this as much as possible from the nursing perspective. So if there is good nursing research, nursing-driven research out there that covers a specific topic that I've discussed, or maybe a topic that you'd like to hear me discuss, send me the links to that information or references to a certain nursing journal or article or research release, and I will do my best to get a hold of that information and present it here either directly on the show or refer to it and put an article about it up on the website. And if you'd like to write a couple of paragraphs about a piece of nursing research and provide me a link back to that research article, we can do that as well and put that up on the site, and I will give you credit where credit is due, of course. So if somebody would like to be a guest blogger or a writer here on the show, that's always an option, and I've extended that option as well to Andrea, or Andrea, as the case may be, here on the show. So I look forward and always enjoy getting emails in from the listeners, and please keep them coming. Let's move on in and take a look at this week's news items for nursing. And I'm going to start off with a story I picked up talking about a possible malaria vaccine. Now, this is being tested right now, and they believe that it might be ready for widespread use as early as 2012. Here in the United States, malaria is not an issue in many ways for us because it's something that was defeated here largely through the use of pesticides that are now banned worldwide, but we were able to really eradicate many aspects of malarial issues here in the United States a long time ago. But worldwide, malaria is one of the greatest killers all over, especially in third world nations. And so having access to a malaria vaccine will greatly improve worldwide health. And so this is exciting. In this particular article, looking at a vaccine that is showing some safety in several different clinical trials and is going to be safely able to be given alongside other childhood vaccines. And that's another aspect that's very important. You have to be able to vaccinate children for all the other childhood diseases and illnesses that they have to be worried about, as well as vaccinate against the malaria parasite. So this is something that's exciting, and I urge you to head over and check out the link in the show notes to this particular article. The study that is looking at this particular article is a study that was published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, we'll have to look at this and see how this affects. But, you know, as people on the forefront of vaccinating children worldwide, you know, nurses are a key part of that process. And for many people, nurses are the only healthcare providers they have regular access to. And it's exciting to have another tool in a nurse's arsenal worldwide to help them maintain health in their local communities and for the people who rely on them so much. Here locally, there is an article I found that is a press release from the National Association of School Nurses, the NASN. And the National Association of School Nurses recently partnered with an organization, a company called Healthy Interactions, and they are going to be working on developing an in-school education program that will help nurses in these schools address important health issues for the children, including childhood obesity, asthma, dealing with problems of psychological nature, like dealing with peer pressure, depression, also the normal things that we have to deal with, like hygiene and getting people to have a more active lifestyle. All of the larger scope of practice that nurses have in the ongoing health of their entire community. And this is exciting, and I'm looking forward to seeing how this is implemented across the nation. Basically, this is going to use a dialogue and a social media aspect to have collaborative learning aspects to improve the healthcare of the students in those schools. So this is an interesting and exciting, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about this. I have contacted the National Association of School Nurses recently, hopefully can have a school nurse here on the show to talk a little bit about their organization and about school nursing here in the United States. For a lot of children, especially in rural areas and especially in inner city areas, nurses provide access to their only primary medical care for a lot of kids. Nurses are involved heavily in teaching children about healthy nutrition, teaching children about healthy sexual activity decisions, and really focusing on all of the child's needs, from having warm clothing in the wintertime all the way up to making sure that they are monitored for problems like diabetes and asthma in the school. So school nurses aren't just giving out Band-Aids and Tylenol. School nurses are also actively involved in having active processes of healthy interaction in the schools. And it's neat to see that they are continuing to provide a leading edge of that
as they partner up with other organizations and companies to provide additional resources for their members in the local schools. Finally, I found an interesting story pop up on my search over at usatoday.com. And you know, I don't usually try to go to the mainline newspapers because they so often get things wrong. But there's a lot of good information linked to in this article, and I think it does a good job of at least presenting some of the key issues. This is a study that was released by a cognitive psychologist from the University of California at Berkeley. And it is looking at the real causes of the disparity in brain function between groups of children at or below the poverty level and groups of children from wealthier families. Now, we've always known that children and from poverty-stricken situations seem to perform more poorly on the exams than children from wealthier families. But what exactly is going on here? Is it just a question of throwing more money into education, or is there actually physiologically an issue going on? This particular study seems to point at some changes in the prefrontal cortex of these children. Basically, the researcher here is likening the differences to something like a stroke. If you can imagine how a stroke affects an elderly person, well, imagine having someone over time have changes and differences in their development of their prefrontal cortex that is similar to having a sudden stroke, but it occurs over a period of time. And so you lead to issues with problem solving, higher order thinking and reasoning, and you know, all of these things lead to poor decision making. And so you can understand why people in certain situations are more involved in riskier behaviors. Now, of course, this is a stereotypical approach because obviously there are people who rise above their poverty situations, but that doesn't happen nearly as often as it should when you compare similar numbers in wealthier and more affluent areas of the country. So this needs to be brought down to our level. How can a nurse help out with this situation? What can we do? Well, we need to think about the fact that these patients are exposed to a lot of different things that lead to these problems, from just intellectual stimulation, living in an environment with toxic problems, lead paint is still one of those things that is constantly an issue in older areas, and all of these things combine to create just a horrible environment for children as they rapidly grow and develop those important brain connections. So what we need to do now is work hard on reducing toxins in the environment, work hard on improving nutrition for people at risk, and improving their ability to have access to a stimulating environment and numerous sources of stimulation so that they can be intellectually stimulated and learn to their full potential. And you know, that's the kind of thing that nurses in the field are very good at in public health, and nurses involved in home care. All of these things, when you assess home situations, you can have a good chance of enacting a rather small change when you think about, you know, lead paint abatement. If you can just recognize and ascertain that the lead paint is at risk in this situation, you can go ahead and help out these families by giving them the opportunity to have a better chance just by doing something as simple as repainting or removing lead paint and repainting the home. A relatively inexpensive solution for a problem that could end up costing hundreds of thousands of dollars in lost productivity and income down the road. So that's this story. As always, there are links to everything in the show notes over at nursingshow.com. Just head over there, and when you get there, look on the left-hand side, click on the podcast category, and you'll find the show notes for this episode and every other episode of the Nursing Show podcast. Time for this week's tip and trick of the week, and we're going to continue on in our ongoing series here looking at antibiotics and just reviewing some of the nursing considerations and other things we need to keep in mind when administering these medications in a facility or educating our patients about taking these medications once they get home.
Today we're going to be talking about the aminoglycosides. The aminoglycosides are really the go-to antibiotic in many cases for problems like hospital-based or nosocomial infections, and are most commonly administered alongside other antibiotics in some cases because of the fact that they work well and potentiate the effects with other antibiotics. So they work well with others, play well with others, I guess you could say, right? So this is commonly seen as medications like streptomycin, gentamicin, and they are very potent and very strong, and they are bactericidal. They're not bacteriostatic, but bactericidal. They actually will destroy the existing bacteria rather than the bacteriostatics, which inhibit the growth of new bacteria. And so just to understand some of the differences there. Contraindications for the administration of aminoglycosides include patients, of course, with any allergies to the medication. Patients have a lot of allergies to antibiotics, so make sure you ascertain if they have specific antibiotic allergies to aminoglycosides. Also, patients with renal or hepatic disease, as so many medications are metabolized by these organs, it's important for us to maintain vigilance at all times for patients with renal or hepatic disease or failure. But in the case of the aminoglycosides, these medications actually can be toxic and cause other issues with the renal system. This medication should be used very cautiously in neonates because of their immature renal systems, and because this is passed through breast milk, caution should be used, or it should be an absolute contraindication in some cases for patients that are lactating and breastfeeding. Also, we need to be careful of patients with pre-existing hearing loss, and that's because this medication causes ototoxicity. It shows up as a problem with the eighth cranial nerve, the auditory nerve, and can cause hearing loss, and that would be difficult to ascertain a problem with that type of toxicity if the patient already has hearing loss issues. So we need to be very careful when administering that to these patients as well. Always make use of your pharmacists in your facilities. Make sure you can double check with them or follow up with an online service that checks medication contraindications as far as interactions. Some medications can mask the toxicity of aminoglycosides. So you'll want to make sure you have a good medication list for any patient taking these drugs outside of a facility. And if you're administering it in a facility, double check interactions with any other medications being administered to these patients. Now, we talked about some of the toxicity seen, and that includes renal toxicity and ototoxicity, but there are also some adverse effects that may be seen. And we're going to see, of course, we're looking for our signs of an allergy to the medication, and that is our rash, itching, as well as, of course, other signs of more severe allergic reaction. But some other effects might be seen include nausea, vomiting, also stomatitis, diarrhea, some weight loss. Patients may complain of headache, and you may also see some signs of paresthesia, dizziness, vertigo, and these signs are going to be indications that there might be toxicity referring to the eighth cranial nerve. So you want to always ask the patient to notify you if they feel like they're dizzy, if they're having experiences of vertigo, the room is spinning, those kind of things. So you need to remember to always bring the communication down to a level that the patients understand. They may not know what vertigo is, but if you tell them, let them know if they get the spins, then they'll be able to communicate with you better. So always make sure that you're not using medical terminology that may be going over their heads. Good follow-up assessment and interaction with your patient communication will help you ascertain whether there are problems with ototoxicity, and that can be just simple as questioning them about signs of dizziness, re-educating them about things to watch for as far as that goes. But as far as your renal problems, you're going to want to be checking all of your renal labs, possibly even doing a urine dip to check for proteinuria, also your labs for increased levels of your BUN and serum creatinine levels. Patients, of course, for greater risk are those patients that have existing renal problems, increasing risk factors for renal problems. So you're going to want to monitor these patients more carefully. Some of our dosing guidelines: if administered IV, you're going to want to make sure that the serum solution has been refrigerated until it's ready to be used, and then infused slowly over about 30 minutes. And you're going to want to make sure you're following up with the patient to make sure you're looking for signs of a reaction during infusion. So you're going to want to monitor your IV lines carefully. Make sure your line's patent, and make sure you're looking for signs that it's irritating the venous insertion site. Also, if you're administering this drug along with penicillin to the same patient, you're going to want to keep the administration of those drugs a couple of hours apart. You're also going to want to monitor peak and trough levels of administration throughout the therapy, making sure that they are maintaining a therapeutic dose level in their system. Again, work with your facility pharmacist. Get to know your pharmacist. They're a resource for you. And you know what? They like to hear about patients and get a little more interaction through you with the patient. They like, now that they're out and on the floors more frequently, that they can be a little bit more of a member of the direct team. And I think that's a good thing to have available for you. So make friends with your pharmacist, I guess, is the theme here. Again, monitor your labs. You'll want to monitor your renal function test, creatinine, BUN. Watch your urinalysis. Watch your patient's output. Also, you want to check for problems with bone marrow suppression, as that may also occur. So monitor your CBC results as well. Make sure the patient's getting adequate fluids, monitoring your intake. Your eyes and nose are always important, but especially important with a lot of the administration of antibiotics in the facility. So keep track of that as well. If the patient's taking this medication at home, make sure that they are following the full course of treatment, not just stopping it as soon as they feel better. We also need to make sure that they are aware of the signs and symptoms of ototoxicity, renal toxicity, and also that they're monitoring for a sign of allergic reaction. And so this is important to keep track of, and just another antibiotic that we need to have a little bit of a handle on so that we know some of the things to be aware of with our patients. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody for checking out this week's show. Remind all of you to go to nursingshow.com and follow up on the great information you've found here. Always check into the links and other resources I put up on the site. I like to provide all of you with some additional resources. Sometimes they're tutorials, sometimes they're good reference articles for you to follow up and gain further knowledge on the 5 or 10 minutes of information that you get from a segment on here on The Nursing Show. I also want to remind you that if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions for future topics, or if you'd like to make a correction, as our friend Paul did this week, please get in touch with me. Make this a community effort and share your knowledge with the other nurses here on The Nursing Show. And you can do that by sending me an email to comments@nursingshow.com. And we'll be happy to get that information here on the show right away. As we close out, I'll end up the show as I always do with some great PodSafe music. Since it's holiday time for me, I'm going to play another Christmas tune for you. And this is a little bit of a rock and roll number. It's Jill Parr and her version of Do You Hear What I Hear? If you like what you hear, you can check it out at Jill's site, Jill Parr with 2 R's.com. And you can also follow the link in the show notes to purchase this song over at iTunes. So if you like what you hear, let her know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I want to remind all of you, especially at this holiday time, to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.